Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, cases of COVID-19 continue to increase in number, but compliance with stay-at-home orders appears to be having an effect. Still, Mecklenburg County has about a quarter of the state's cases. Mayor Vi Lyles announces a new community recovery task force focusing on small businesses, housing, and the airport once the recovery begins. Plans for additional hospital space change. Details on that and on the demographics of the virus. NYCMS was the only district in the state excluded from additional COVID-19 funding. Our roundtable of reporters is set to fill us in on those stories and more. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News. Good morning.
Morning, Mike.
Annie Ma joins us. She is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Jonathan Lowe is anchor reporter for Spectrum News. No tie this morning. Good morning.
No, just a hoodie. Good morning, Mike.
And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSSC TV Channel 9. Eyewitness News. Thank you for being here, Joe.
Hey, Mike.
The number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise here and around the country. 2 weeks ago, the state reported 667 cases. Last week, 1,886. This morning, 3,698 with 72 deaths. That's up from, I think, 17 a week ago. 2 weeks ago, Mecklenburg County reported 207 cases. Last week, 495. This morning, 869 with 10 coronavirus deaths reported here. That's up from 2 from last week. We, as I said, we have a quarter of the cases in the state. Wake County is second with 388. These numbers may be, these were current as of yesterday afternoon. One death in Iredell County, one in Cabarrus, two in Rowan. Gaston County has reported 3 deaths. Fewer than 48,000 tests, though, have been conducted, and 398 people are in the hospital statewide. Is this the kind of impact that was predicted as we went into this crisis and made us take this seriously? Or are these numbers actually better? Who wants to take
that,
Steve?
I'll jump in just real quick and say, I think at this point, I think they're a little better. I mean, if you go back in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg to a couple of weeks ago, the increase day over day was around 20%. It's now, you know, that was right when the stay-at-home order went into effect. Now it's gone down, then it went down to about 10% day over day. And then this past week, it's really slowed down, 8%, 5%, under 5%. So, and I think you're seeing that in some of the projections in terms of hospitals, beds needed, day of the peak, total cases. So I think that the kind of takeaway is stay at home has been working. And then the state of North Carolina on that same trajectory is about a week behind Mecklenburg because their order went into effect later. So I think if you look at the last 3 days, it's pretty good news, much better than it was a week ago.
And a lot of local leaders are starting to sound a little more optimistic in their press conferences. They really did say that the curve is starting to flatten, but they don't want the public celebrating just yet. They said that, you know, that we really can't take our foot off the gas here. We actually have to increase social distancing efforts so we can ensure that this curve remains flat and we remain on this good path.
And Mike, you know, put a national point on this that yesterday during the White House task force briefing, Dr. Anthony Fauci lowered the national death estimate to 60,000. So, you know, we were talking last week in the hundreds of thousands, right, as far as deaths. So, you know, he even went as far as to talk about the possibility of summer vacation. You know, that he said that's a leap, but it is possible if we continue following those social distancing guidelines.
And that's the only thing in our arsenal is social distancing. So that if the numbers are going down, is it because of that? Absolutely. Or is it because even though they say we have more cases than are being reported because testing is really low throughout the United States, we should have more cases than these numbers indicate. Is it because we don't, or is it because of social distancing? How do we know?
I think it's, you can't really know. And that's the thing about the data nationwide. It's not very consistent. Some people report testing, some people have less robust testing, but I think we all know just based on the science that social distancing does work. So I don't know that those two questions, like one answers the other. Like it's clear that, you know, from local and state officials that we're going to have to keep social distancing. But it's hard to read into the numbers because testing is just inconsistent.
I'll add to that, though. We did see a drop in the number of hospitalizations, and that is key because that gives us a signal on how many are two things, really. How many are becoming severely ill and having to be hospitalized? And then you think further about the impact that that puts on the hospitals and the healthcare workers and all of the protective equipment, the things that we've been talking about since the beginning, easing the impact so that the hospitals can catch up.
Yeah. I think the hospitalization number is a pretty good number, right? Yeah. You know, we talk about like crime stats, those can be like, are those really true, et cetera? And the same thing with cases. But I think probably the hospitalizations for COVID is coming pretty close to capturing the severity.
Absolutely.
Of cases. I mean, I don't think that many are being missed. So I think that's a good benchmark.
South Carolina was slow to the social distancing game or the stay at home game. I guess Henry McMaster, the governor down there, took a long time to issue any kind of order or any kind of suggestion. What is the situation, Joe, in South Carolina?
So yesterday, South Carolina announced 241 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total to 2,792. And the state's death total is currently at 67. For the longest time, North Carolina has been trending behind South Carolina with deaths, but I believe, unfortunately, we're going to slowly take over that total, have more deaths as this progresses, because we are sitting at 65 at 11 a.m. on Thursday morning. Locally, Chester, South Carolina has 16 cases, Chesterfield 21, Lancaster 51, and York 120. South Carolina seems to have had a little more outbreaks in nursing homes, something that we haven't seen here in Mecklenburg County too much. I believe only two nursing homes at this point have had outbreaks in Mecklenburg.
North Carolina State epidemiologist Zach Moore says our state is still in the acceleration phase of this pandemic and that there were new projections this week about the coronavirus curve in the state. One of those projections came from the University of Washington. It anticipates the virus here to peak next week with fewer deaths projected and enough hospital space to handle the influx of patients. But another report from UNC and Duke says cases would rise dramatically if distancing measures were not extended past April. Here's Governor Roy Cooper.
As confining and frustrating as it is, we have to continue the stay-at-home order and the other interventions. They are working.
So despite indications that we are successfully so-called flattening this curve in Mecklenburg, our numbers here and around the state are continuing to rise. So are people in the state and here in the are people in the state and here in the metro area cooperating with the stay-at-home orders? Is it happening? Is it happening enough?
So, you know, this is a question that kind of is difficult to answer because for the most part, you see that people are following the stay-at-home orders. But just a couple of days ago, I went over to Freedom Park, and it was after the county manager had closed the gates. But people can still walk in, and there is a sign out there saying the park is open, you can only walk in. You know, Mike, I saw a number of families with small children, groups of people more than what's recommended. Going into the park, taking yoga mats, doing things, taking shared equipment. I saw all of this and this is just a couple of days ago. This isn't 2 weeks ago when all this was new for most people. So I think there are isolated pockets still. If you go to some of the neighborhood parks, some of the county parks, you will still see people not following those social distancing guidelines. Yeah. I think the vast majority, according to CMPD, Sheriff's Office and county officials, the vast majority of people are taking it seriously.
Go ahead, Annie.
I think if you think about how local officials have responded, like the closing of, like Jonathan said, entrances and parking at the parks, it's sort of like they're like chasing every loophole and closing them down. So it feels like overall it's working, but there are some, like Jonathan said, pockets and loopholes that need to be tamped down because people are trying everything.
CMPD reported 1,400 calls from people complaining about other people not practicing social distancing. And as you mentioned, Jonathan, the county closed the gates to parks and greenways, so you cannot bring your car into these parks. You can walk in, but you can't bring your car into them. And if that doesn't do the trick, Dina DiOrio, the county manager, says they might close the parks altogether.
If we continue to aggressively enforce the existing order and every resident in the county stays home and practices social distancing, no additional restrictions should be needed.
So that's Mecklenburg County. But Steve, you were telling me this morning before we started that in Gaston County, the chairman of the Gaston County Commission has sent a letter, I guess with other folks, to the governor asking him not to extend the stay-at-home order beyond the current deadline, which is the end of the month.
That's right. You know, Gaston has, I think they have about 73 cases now, 50 have recovered. They've seen, they saw a big increase like everyone else, but then their curve is flattened too. And Tracy Philbeck feels, he's the chair of the commission, that at the end of the month, they will continue to take steps. They will continue to do social distancing, but he wants flexibility to perhaps allow groups to meet if they keep the 6 feet apart. He just wants to be able to do his own thing. And I think this is going to be an interesting, really interesting moving forward. I think you're going to hear a lot more of this. And the question is going to be, you know, we at the start of this, the big thing was flatten the curve, right? We needed to flatten the curve so the hospitals wouldn't be overwhelmed. And that seems to be working. So then the debate, now we're going to shift to, are we trying to eliminate it entirely? Are we trying to really drive down new cases to almost zero? And that's where I think there's going to be a lot of tension in the state. Mecklenburg seems to be taking that approach. They seem to want to like snuff out every possible new case, whereas Gaston, and I think others, are going to say, we are going to try and manage this situation as best we can.
But can you have it both ways? You can't close the I-85 bridge into right. Gaston County. So if they're not going to do it, and we are, who are we just wasting our time?
And Mike, let me just, while we're on this point, it's not the health professionals, Dr. Anthony Fauci included, has said that we don't just need to be concerned about the peak that we're going to see in 2 weeks, possibly here in the springtime. They are, excuse me, concerned about a resurgence in the fall. So until we get a vaccine and until these clinical trials are done, I think that the concern about lifting these requirements too early could have us set up a situation where we have another resurgence of COVID-19 cases in the fall. Things tamper down in the summer and then it picks back up in the fall.
Danny.
Yeah. And that's exactly, not to be like pedantic and historical, but that's exactly what happened with the 1918 Spanish flu. Like, cities that let up their social distancing policy saw a huge resurgence after that. So I think that's when we talk about flattening the curve, it's kind of like you guys said, it's a long-term curve and not just immediate.
I think there's a question of whether you can really kill the curve entirely, because like earlier, just a few minutes ago, we were talking about the parks and the loopholes and people getting together. But think about all the social interactions that are allowed today under the stay-at-home order. I mean, think about the thousands of interactions between customers and grocery store clerks, people at Lowe's, people at Target. That's all allowed. That's okay. That is, I think, probably a much higher risk, or, you know, food takeout at restaurants. There's so many possibilities to keep community spread going on a small scale.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone here is prepared to go into full lockdown like Italy.
I have 20 seconds, Steve, but you're our political reporter. How much of this is driven by just different political points of view? Because Gaston County's commissioner is a Republican, and Democrats in control Mecklenburg.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big part. I'm not saying that Gaston County is like taking its orders from the president, but I think they just have a view of like, of kind of a different thing, that it's important to try and reopen and get back on their feet and manage the situation.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison joins us from WFAE News, Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. And Joe, new rules came out yesterday involving cats. They will now be limiting the number of passengers. What did they decide?
Yeah, so cats is going to limit the amount of passengers on a bus to 20. And drivers have the ability to tell folks, hey, you can't get on the bus right now, it's too crowded. They're also going to start putting X's on seats and mark off tape, mark on the floor with tape 6 feet so people know how far away they have to stay from each other.
And because they're reducing capacity on some lines at some times, they are adding buses, right?
Correct.
Is the same true of links?
So with the light rail vehicles, there's a little more space on the trains, so they don't have to limit the amount of people on them at this point, but they are still going to put markings on the ground to show where 6 feet is.
So they're using these methods to keep ridership down so they can improve social distancing at the same time that they've waived the fares, which would encourage, one would presume, more people to ride. Are we getting mixed messages here?
Well, you know what's interesting? John Lewis, the head of CATS, put out a video yesterday telling people not to ride public transportation for an essential reason. You have the CEO of the transit saying, don't use transit.
Yeah.
I never thought that would ever happen.
He said only use it for life-sustaining trips to groceries, pharmacies, or jobs deemed essential. And the mayor suggested, I think last week, that they might shut the transit system down. Are they still considering that, or are these new numbers that we're getting that seem to be better than anticipated something that will take that off the table?
You know, she said that, but officials really tried to put toothpaste back in the tube after that. At this point, they are not considering any public transportation shutdown. The mayor kind of said that it's an option if
everything's on the table.
Really bad, but that's not under consideration at this point.
So something else came down yesterday from the governor. He signed an executive order requiring new social distancing policies at the stores that remain open. What are those new requirements?
So basically, they're going to limit the amount of people that are in a grocery store or Lowe's at one time. A lot of businesses have already started doing this voluntarily, but starting Monday at 5 p.m., they will have no choice. And the executive order says they're limiting the number of people inside at one time so that it is no more than 20% of the stated fire capacity or 5 people for every 1,000 square feet.
Wow. Yeah, and to add to that, a lot of stores now have done one direction of travel down the aisles. A lot of stores now have boxes where you know, at the register, where you stand, you're 6 feet apart. So there's certainly a lot of stores in the area that have kind of already started what Joe just mentioned.
Go ahead. That's right. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say that, I mean, and I think those rules, I think when businesses do reopen, whether it's May, June, July, whenever, I mean, I would assume that is going to be standard everywhere. I mean, any kind of business that opens will, you know, people will be waiting outside to go in if it's too crowded. I mean, and that may be with us for months. That just may be how we shop now.
I was grocery shopping the other day and I was wearing a mask. Other customers were wearing masks. None of the employees.
None, Mike.
Masks.
You
zero.
Are absolutely right. I went to Lowe's and Home Depot yesterday and the customers had masks on. At Lowe's, they have you can only go in and out of the indoor area. Do your shopping there. You have to come out and then go separately to the garden area. But unfortunately, I didn't see any employees with masks on. And I was like, can I give you one of my masks out of my car? Like, it was really bizarre.
I'm not going to tell you which chain because that would be unfair because this is anecdotal and not necessarily store policy. But I asked as I was having my turkey cut at the deli counter and he wasn't wearing a mask. I said, aren't you guys wearing masks? He says, no, they don't really want us to because it doesn't look good. Now, Harris Teeter yesterday has now said they will be wearing masks, right?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, and you're talking, Steve brought up the takeout part of how, you know, that the we could still see community spread through avenues like that. Well, I have a relative, and just like you, won't name them specifically, but she does DoorDash. And she sent me videos from four different restaurants. None of the employees in the back were wearing masks.
That would seem to me to be dangerous. If this is, if we're wearing them to protect the other person, not ourselves, we're wearing.
And you're preparing food, standing over food.
Preparing food, standing over food. That doesn't make any sense at all. That should be a requirement, it seems to me.
And I've seen, like, she sent me video. So this is something I've seen with my own eye.
Annie.
And I think this was from a couple of weeks ago, but there's certainly a lot of this conversation playing out among grocery and like essential workers. Like you saw the Instacart work stoppage, the Whole Foods work stoppage, and a lot of that was based on feeling like they weren't being compensated for the hazards they were facing and that they weren't being prepared with personal protective equipment. And so I think it's something that's probably going to stay in the conversation going forward.
I don't know, Joe, if you've heard, but I don't know if I've heard from any county official specifically on these essential workers and, you know, what guidelines they have.
Right. There's been some mixed messaging, and I'm not sure if Mecklenburg County has specifically come out and said, hey, everyone should wear a mask out in public. I know Lincoln County put something out saying that yesterday, and I know that Senator Tom Tillis in an interview with me yesterday encouraged everyone to wear masks outside in public. But, you know, I kind of give a little bit of a grace period for some workers because there has been that mixed messaging. The CDC said don't wear masks, and now everyone's starting to encourage people to do so. By the end of next week, though, if people aren't wearing masks out in public or these essential workers aren't people that are handling our food, then it really becomes inexcusable.
One of the things we've heard about consistently across the country with regard to this outbreak of coronavirus is the terrible toll that it is taking among the elderly, particularly those who are in nursing homes. And yesterday, the governor made mandatory protective measures that had only been suggested for nursing homes up to this point. Jonathan, what did he change?
So there are now requirements, Mike, for people who work in they're called congregate living facilities. So that's anything from a nursing home to a jail. And essentially what these workers now have to have their temperatures taken at the beginning of each shift. They have to have protective gear. They also have stopped visitations at these facilities. So, you know, you had a lot of family members who were still trying to care for their loved ones who were in nursing homes. But now we're seeing, you know, a huge outbreak among nursing homes. So the governor really came out day before yesterday to announce that. And the problem has certainly gotten worse since then.
So Cindy emails us. I just spoke to someone at the Mecklenburg County Public Health Hotline because of the two nursing homes that now have cases of COVID-19. They indicated that it is still up to the executive directors at those facilities to choose whether or not to disclose this to other residents and family
Correct.
Members. We have family members in those communities, she writes. How can this information be withheld?
Before Joe answers that, the numbers are alarming. There are, yesterday it was 21. I believe the number's gone up by three. So 24 congregate living facilities across the state that have outbreaks. 16 of those are at nursing homes. And we have what counties? Burke, Cabarrus, Cleveland, Mecklenburg, and Rowan, at least in our area, all have at least one nursing home with an outbreak. And an outbreak, just to be, in case anybody's wondering, is two or more confirmed laboratory cases.
So, Joe, you said that's a good question. Why don't we have an answer for it?
It's frustrating because the county doesn't have to withhold this information. They can provide it, and they're just not. South Carolina has named nursing homes where there are outbreaks there. It's just they're hiding behind patient privacy, but the HIPAA does not prevent them from saying which nursing homes are having outbreaks. And it's frustrating for people yep. who have loved ones in nursing homes because they are at the nursing home's whim on whether they find out whether the outbreak is at their facility.
Now, and I have a
nursing home that we do know has had an outbreak in Mecklenburg County is the Pavilion Health Center. And again, we only know that because they notified people about it. We don't know where that second one is.
And so I have people calling. I'm sure Joe does too. I have people calling me wondering, you know, saying to me, I have a family member who goes, who's at a nursing home in Cabarrus County. Which one is it? And it's impossible to figure out from the county officials what these nursing homes are, where they are.
So across the country, we've heard the term flattening the curve and the importance of doing that so that our hospital systems will not be overwhelmed. And evidently, that's not going to happen here. At least that's the newest projection. It's not going to happen here. We'll talk about why in a little while. But Mecklenburg County is working to flatten the curve in a different way. Joe, you reported they have hired an organization that deals with social influencers. Tell me more.
So right now, the county says one of their concerns is that young people who aren't plugged into the news or aren't following this regularly are not listening to the stay-at-home orders. We're still seeing a majority of the cases 20 to 59 years old. They're really focusing on that younger age range, the 20 to 30 range, who don't follow the news regularly. So they're hiring this firm that works with influencers, and they're going to start paying these people to roll out posts promoting social distancing and COVID-19 messaging.
So let's be clear about this. These are people who are people follow on Facebook and Twitter, and they have a following, and I actually follow some of these people. It's really interesting. But when they are paid to do this, they become commercial spokespeople. And when they divulge, well, I've been paid to tell you this, I immediately ignore whatever they're saying. Because they're shills. You know, why do young people believe that?
The local governments are starting to do this. So they're paying people a couple $1,000 to produce a video of COVID-19 or opioid misuse. And, you know, one influencer that I spoke to who hasn't been contacted by the county yet, he had 3.2 million viewers on TikTok. So if the county can toss like $1,000 to this guy and he can produce 5 or 10 videos, they're reaching 3.2 million people there. So
you know what that means? Do you know what that means? That means all the work that you do at Channel 9, all the work that Jonathan does at Channel at Spectrum, all the work that we all do, we're all overpaid. Because we don't have 3 million followers. So we're all overpaid. All right, since the curve is flattening here. Since the curve is flattening here, our two hospitals have now said they don't need to use UNC Charlotte as an emergency hospital. The university had volunteered some dorm space for that. But when County Commissioner Trevor Fuller spoke about this at the County Commission meeting this week, the flattening of the curve wasn't the only reason for shifting emergency hospital priorities.
I am saddened that we will not have any federal or state support to do it. We are blessed in Mecklenburg County that we do have resources to be able to protect our people. But I regret that we have to do it alone.
So we are the largest county in the state and the one with the largest number of COVID-19 cases. It is one thing, I suppose, not to get any extra federal help for this during this crisis. But why would funding from North Carolina be absent from Mecklenburg County?
Well, the issue is staffing and supplies. And as we've heard from emergency management at the state and Governor Roy Cooper, the state is having a lot of issues getting personal protective gear. And, you know, staffing is so thin across the state that they're begging retired people to come out of retirement and start working these hospitals. The funding isn't necessarily the issue right now, because eventually Mecklenburg County will be reimbursed for all of this. The reason why they are scaling back, one of the reasons why, is because of that lack of staffing and supplies and the support they receive from FEMA.
And there will be no staffing or supply help either from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or the state's emergency agency, but the Army Corps of Engineers would come in and build the field hospital that we're now talking about doing. When the city's deputy director of emergency management spoke about this change toward a smaller field hospital on this program on Wednesday, Robert Graham said the funding has to be ironed out, as does the location, which hopefully will be between the two hospitals, Novant and Atrium. But there are other considerations too.
The two things that are going to be the hardest for us are supplies, and that includes ventilators, and staffing. And so because this is a national emergency and we are under a national state of emergency, the staffing and the supplies have to be sourced locally.
So we won't be getting help from the state or the federal government on supplies?
No. I mean, I think that if you, and I'm not trying to defend the federal government here, but if you look at, there's obviously been a ton of problems with the system, but if you look at the country as a whole and you think like, where are the biggest needs? I mean, I just think if you look at the data, Mecklenburg County is not going to be at the top of the list. I mean, if we somehow get a ton of ventilators, I think you could really make an argument those would be better put in New Orleans, Detroit, okay. New Jersey, you know. So, and I think it's going to, you know, the University of Washington study puts this peak coming really in Mecklenburg County really soon, what, in a week or two? So I think it's going to be interesting to watch, like, does even the 600-bed hospital go through with 600 beds? Is it smaller? Does it even happen? I think it just, the number day to day, it changes the curve.
Joe.
Yeah, these things change quickly. Last Friday, we were talking about a 3,000 bed field hospital. Now we're talking about a 600 bed field hospital. It's kind of like a weather forecast. The models change. And right now we're doing a good job at flattening the curve. And the hope is that number, the need for a field hospital, continues to go down.
So there's no vaccine for this virus. There are just a few drugs that medical professionals and officials have referred to as agents that might help in easing the suffering from this virus and might tamp it down in the body. The president keeps mentioning hydroxychloroquine. He says that, what do you got to lose? Well, apparently you have a lot to lose because a lot of doctors are coming out nationally and saying that stuff can kill you if it's not administered properly or if you have a bad reaction to it. But this week, all the news outlets have been reporting in town on a clinical trial at Novant that could help patients recover faster. What is this clinical trial, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's really cool. So Novant is the first site in the southeast United States that's going to initiate phase two clinical trial for, this is for COVID-19 patients, though, that have mild to moderate symptoms. So Novant's second clinical trial site in the country, and they're looking at a drug called, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, so medical professionals who are listening, please forgive me, but it's called Lamab, I believe, and it's they are testing 75 planned patients in up to 10 centers in the United States. The FDA gave them fast track designation to, I think it's called Cytoden, for two potential indications of Lamab for deadly diseases. It's used typically in as a combination therapy for HIV infected patients and metastatic triple negative breast cancer patients.
How do you get on the trial? How do you get on the trial? Very quickly.
I believe these patients have already been selected, enrolled in the phase two clinical trial.
We have to stop. We'll come back and talk about education and the Small Business Task Force in just a moment on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer, Joe Bruno from Channel 9, and Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. When Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles was on this program earlier this week, she started off by announcing the establishment of a community recovery task force.
We're going to work to develop ideas and plans for how we look forward to the recovery when this pandemic is over. How do we make sure that we can get our community back?
So what exactly is this task force and how will it work? Anybody?
It's like the Charlotte City Council committee eventually, and they'll make recommendations for how the city of Charlotte can support changes in various different segments that have been impacted because of COVID-19. There's a small business one, a housing one, and an airport committee. So these small groups will meet. Just essentially, they're like more committees that Charlotte City Council has, and they'll specifically focus on these areas for COVID-19.
And she really talked about the airport being something we need to reestablish because it's an economic engine for the city. But that really, it seems to me, is up to the return of regular airline travel and the national situation. She also stressed the importance of helping the hospitality industry. She told us on this program Wednesday that the restaurant and tourism industries would be first and foremost in the city's economic recovery efforts, that they'd be using hospitality taxes in this effort. But $110 million of that money had been promised for Major League Soccer. And I had to ask a couple of times about this, but I think you can tell me if I'm right, got an answer about whether that money would now be redirected to more pressing concerns.
I don't have an answer to that right now, because we need to find the needs, we have to find the solutions, and there are no definitions around that right now. From our property tax, our sales tax, from our hospitality taxes, I'm saying that we would need to be thoughtful, we need to be responsive, and we need to be prudent for our future.
So read between the lines. She has said that everything is on the table. So what does that mean? Is the $110 million on the table?
I asked kind of a similar question during the press conference with her, asking if it's untouchable.
Joe, she gave me a similar non-answer. Joe, we just lost you when you said untouchable. So pick it up from there.
You had me. Okay. I asked a similar question. I asked if it's untouchable, and she gave me a similar non-answer that she just gave you. But it seems the one thing she said is that is not our top priority right now. So reading between the lines, it would imply to me that money, it's not going to be rolling out to David Tepper anytime soon.
Okay. I think Joe, like my interpretation, again, this is all like really reading tea leaves, right? We're all guessing on this one. I think, remember, she said like that no money is going to be going out the door until we finish the long-term study, which has always been kind of the statement that like we have to do that study about the entertainment district. And so that study was never going to be done for 2 years, a year, 2 years. So if you think no money's going out the door, I interpret that as no money's going to David Tepper and no money is going anywhere. So it's just kind of still sitting in the bank.
So the county commission on Tuesday night approved $5 million to fund two emergency loan programs for businesses. What businesses can take advantage of these loans?
They have a small business fund for businesses with fewer than 50 people, and they have a micro business fund for businesses with fewer than 5 people.
And the federal government has a federal loan program now for small businesses affected by the coronavirus. It began last Friday. It's part of that $2 trillion package that Congress passed. It's called the Paycheck Protection Program. But evidently, it has gotten off to a rocky start. What is the problem?
Yeah, I've seen some business owners say they're having trouble applying for the loans. And then I think there's a lot of confusion from banks as well about who they're supposed to administer them to.
Yeah.
And I think that.
Go ahead.
I think the banks have been overwhelmed too. Just like the amount of paperwork and the amount of demand. It's nothing they've ever seen before.
Right. So there are 100 counties, Annie, in North Carolina, 100 counties in North Carolina, 99 of them have received coronavirus relief funding for each public and charter school student in those counties. Mecklenburg was the only county left out. And Mecklenburg County State Senator Natasha Marcus has a serious question about that.
What kind of formula is it that excludes only one county? When, I will add, we are the county with the most number of COVID-19 cases in the state by a lot.
Why were we left out, Annie?
Can you hear me, Mike?
Yes, I can hear you, but your picture
Perfect.
Is frozen. Okay.
Okay. So the way that the funding worked is that Mecklenburg did get $2.4 million. About half of the $50 million Cooper set aside was allocated per student headcount. And then the other half was considered a boost to low wealth counties, and they used a legislated formula to calculate a bunch of indices based on, I believe, property tax, income, and density. And in that calculation, Mecklenburg is at the top. But instead, the way that it's normally used a formula is that some counties get a supplement, and then other counties that meet a certain cutoff don't. And so But this time they just used Mecklenburg as a baseline and every other county got some proportion relative to how much less wealthy they were to Mecklenburg. And it caused a stir because a lot of wealthy counties like Wake and Guilford did get big checks out of it. Well,
there's $50 million in this fund that the governor set aside for relief for schools. Half of the money was divided up based on the number of enrolled students, targeting four things: meal services, emergency child care, remote learning, and cleaning and sanitizing the schools. The other half was based on low wealth percentage, designed to give counties with smaller tax bases a boost. I can understand how we would not be part of the $25 million that goes to poor counties, because we're not a poor county, but how can you, in any stretch of the imagination, given all the needs that Mecklenburg County and its students have, eliminate us from any funding whatsoever?
So the state board chair said, Eric Davis said, for this round they wanted
who used to be the school board president here in Mecklenburg.
Yes, yeah, he used to be the board chair of CMS, and he said they wanted to consider a local county's ability to fund their own school system, because that's the way school funding works here in North Carolina, and that's why it was allocated based on this wealth and property tax and income tax revenue formula. You know, the criticism that I've heard is that, well, if you're going to do that, that's fine, but just exclude the county, like exclude all the counties who are capable of supporting their own system. I don't think anybody would say that Wake County is unable to write a check to support Wake County schools.
14 state senators and representatives from the county put out a joint statement criticizing the formula that came up with these results, characterizing it as unfairly cutting out one of the neediest counties during this time of crisis. Is that the only route of appeal that people have in Mecklenburg?
Well, I think it's kind of, if it is the only route of appeal, it's worked. The state board has said that they won't use this formula going forward, and that the federal funds, which Eric Davis told me was about hundreds of millions of dollars, will be allocated based on poverty percentages, which will really be a boost to Mecklenburg. You know, I think that given all the like fuss that has been stirred up by 14 state senators and representatives as a powerful voice, they're certainly sort of setting the precedent that this is unacceptable, and it seems unlikely that they're going to use this formula again.
So CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston also told the school board on Wednesday night that his request for an additional $37 million in the budget from the county was probably no longer realistic. He told the board the county has told him that the school should expect a flat budget. He had presented a $1.6 billion budget plan. So remind us how that extra $37 million was going to be used.
So a big chunk of that is not actually for anything new. The CMS has to support a lot of unfunded mandates and pass-through funding from the state. And so some of that is making sure part of the CMS budget is headcount allotments for charter schools in Mecklenburg County. And some of it is like the class size mandate, which the state passed but never allocated money for building new schools to make class sizes smaller. It's essentially keeping the budget flat would be a budget cut from other areas, because I want to say 22 million of that 37 million increase comes from things that they just have to do anyway because of the new school year. So it's going to be tough, and I'm going to be interested to see where those cuts come from. And a lot of what the new budget emphasized was student wellness, socio-emotional learning, those kinds of things.
Something else came up during the conversations at the school board meeting on Wednesday, and that was the money for technology and the technology infrastructure at CMS, because some cracks are showing up now that kids are learning from home and online learning is the only way they're going to learn. Some students have been sent home with devices, and the system says it expects they might lose up to 15% of those devices, which would cost between $1.5 and $2 million to replace them. Why? These devices, I guess they're computers, Chromebooks and things like that, have been handed out. They don't expect them to be returned?
Well, I think a lot of this is like factored into just the normal CMS considerations. Right. You know, like computers get broken, accidents happen. I think they just expect that to be happening on a greater scale when they're not, you know, checked back in with the teacher at the end of the day. And they're working on, you know, creating the repair infrastructure to kind of deliver those services at home as well.
The other thing they talked about was they made an announcement that employees who work essential on-site jobs while the schools are closed will receive time and a half pay beginning on Monday. What are those jobs? Are they mostly food service jobs?
They are mostly food service jobs. I believe payroll and security, just things that require you to be physically on CMS's campuses will also be eligible for that. But I want to say the bulk of them, about two-thirds of the funding for that, will go towards meal service.
So why does the school feel they need to increase the pay for that?
I think there's certainly a sense of, you know, these employees are risking additional exposure to the virus. We should compensate them for the risk they're taking. But there's also a consideration that with the very generous leave policies passed by the state and the local school board, there's concerns that out of fear or other considerations, employees are like, well, if I'm just going to get my regular pay, I don't want to take on this big risk.
Let's be clear that the food service workers are not just in the kitchen. They are serving 37,000 meals a day at 70 meal sites. So they are interfacing with
people. And even behind in the kitchen, they're interfacing with each other more so than they would be if they stayed at home on leave. And I think there's concern that so many people will take leave that they're not going to be able to, they're going to have to shut down the meal program, which would be devastating to a lot of families in CMS and in Mecklenburg County.
And very quickly, North Carolina schools have asked lawmakers to suspend student testing requirements due to this pandemic. What will that mean for end-of-year testing? What will it mean? How do you promote a child to the next grade level if you don't do end-of-year testing?
I think these are a lot of the questions the state board and the state legislature need to answer and are beginning to have discussions about answering. But it's just pretty clear, I think, to everyone in the ed policy world that end-of-year testing is unrealistic. And so I think a lot of that is adjusting our expectations based off of those assumptions now.
So there was news, Jonathan, out of Delhi, India this week about the environmental impact of coronavirus, because people around the world have been laid off and are not going to work. And evidently, the residents of Delhi, India, are enjoying blue skies for the first time in decades, it says. The air no longer has an acrid metallic taste or smell. And you reported this week and spoke to a professor of geology at UNC Charlotte about this so-called unintentional experiment that seems to be playing out around the world. Staying home is helping us.
It's actually, you know, I use the term, it's kind of been a level setting for the environment in a lot of different ways that we're seeing data now coming out. What kind of got my attention first with this story, Mike, was the fact that seismologists in Belgium were the first to notice that there was a 30 to 50% reduction in the amount of seismic vibration. So nothing's changed with the earth. It's just because there are so many lockdowns and stay-at-home orders across the world, the earth is basically vibrating less. And they were the first ones to notice it after that country's lockdown first began. So seismologists across the country begin to pick up on the same thing. So essentially, you know, you get to see how much human interference is caused or is not caused when we all stay home. Air quality they are seeing is the atmospheric science professor at UNCC that I spoke to said that the data will take a little bit more time to compile and figure out, but they're starting to see that there is much less carbon monoxide in the atmosphere. And then finally, I don't know if you've seen any of the pictures, but the canals in Venice, the water has actually turned clear in a lot of the canals that were polluted because of all the traffic. That's one of the main reasons that people go to Italy, and especially Venice, is the canals. And so they were heavily polluted before that country's lockdown. And literally, if you just Google pictures, I did the same. You can see that the water is in many areas of Venice is now clear. So it's just one of the miraculous things that we're now beginning to see how much human interference we bring to the table and how much is taken back when we all stay home. It's kind of, you know, allowing the environment to recover in a small way. But will this, we've seen this same thing happen in other crises, and the environmentalists say, you know, are we going to take this information and do more with it when we do start to recover?
The air and the water, I understand. I'll be interested to find out what the lack of vibration of the earth means to all of us. Maybe that's why I can't sleep. There's no
Too quiet.
Jonathan Lowe, reporter, anchor for Spectrum News. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9. Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.